Welcome, and thanks for listening to the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of readings and interviews with writers, editors, and agents. This week on the podcast, we speak with Tayimba Jess and F. Douglas Brown. Both poets have strong ties to Kaveh Kanem. Kaveh Kanem is a home for the many voices of African-American poetry and is committed to cultivating the artistic and professional growth of African-American poets. Jess's first collection, Lead Belly, published in 2005 by Verse Press, is an exploration of the blues musician Huddy Lead Belly Ledbetter's life. Library Journal and Black Issues Book Review both named it one of the best poetry books of 2005. Jess's honors include a Whiting Writers Award, a Literature Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, a Chicago Sun-Times Poetry Award, and a Gwendolyn Brooks Open Mic Poetry Award. He has also been Artist in Residence at Kaveh Kanem. Oleo, his next book, is forthcoming from Wave Books in April 2016. Jess is an associate professor of English at the College of Staten Island. F. Douglas Brown is the 2013 Kaveh Kanem Poetry Prize recipient for 0-3, published by University of Georgia Press in 2014. Brown, an educator for nearly 20 years, teaches English at Loyola High School of Los Angeles, an all-boys Jesuit school. He is both a Kaveh Kanem and a Kundiman fellow. When he is not teaching, writing, or with his two children, Isaiah and Olivia, he is busy DJing in the greater Los Angeles area. So I'm here today with Tayimba Jess and F. Douglas Brown, who goes by Doug, and we're going to chat a little bit about their latest books, Kaveh Kanem, their poetry, contemporary poetry. So I wanted to start just by asking Tayimba and Doug to tell us about their first books. Each of them has a first book out. Just chat a little bit about what it's about and what your style is there.
Well, okay, my first book was called Lead Belly, and it was about Huddy Ledbetter, the guitarist, folk guitarist, who lived from around 1884, 1885 or so, until 1949. And basically, it's a biography in verse in the voice of Lead Belly and people and objects around him. That's it in a nutshell.
And for me, my book, 0-3, really is interested in fatherhood, being father too, and all the issues or complications of fatherhood. So it really looks at my two kids, Isaiah and Olivia, and then my father, Fred Brown, who passed away about 6 years ago.
Okay, and one question that I have for both of you is, do you consider yourself project poets in terms of you each have a book out where it's heavily themed in one way or another, whether it's Lead Belly or it's fatherhood? So can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, for me, I think I try to go against just saying, I'm working on this project, because so many things come at me a lot, and then I just start to put it in a box, and then I don't deal with it. But there are things I'm definitely working on. When this book came out, or I think before it came out, I was having a hard time with it because I felt like I had to get everything about fatherhood in this book. And a friend of mine said, you should just write every baby mama drama poem there is. And I just really didn't feel that. And somebody really said, no, this isn't going to be your only book about fatherhood. So I am working with another poet. We're working on a collaborative book about fatherhood. He also published a book about fatherhood. And it's been good. It's been good. And the work has been coming. So am I the daddy poet or part of it? I don't know. But it's been a trend with Black poets this past couple of years, which is good, I think, in terms of what they say about us and fatherhood. And you have some really amazing poets looking at it. So,
who are some other poets who are writing about fatherhood, Black poets?
So the poet I'm collaborating with, Jeffrey Davis, Douglas Kearney's last book, Pattern, Kevin Young's book. I mean, his last couple books have looked at fatherhood. I think even Gregory Pardolo, you know, you could say, you know, he's looking at fatherhood. And, you know, I would say even Terrence Hayes. So.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, that idea of feeling like if you're working on a theme, like the pressure to do everything about that theme. And I can imagine that could be a little bit paralyzing. So talking about, how about you for project poetry? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm probably more of a project poet than most. Lead Belly was about one person. I followed him more or less all the way through his life. And this next project, Oleo, is themed in a kind of way, but it's all about people from like the time period just before Lead Belly. So I'm like historical and biographical, and I tend to hew towards a focus point or focal points that get me through a manuscript.
So for these poems where you're writing from a persona or about these different historical and biographical figures, do you feel like these poems are still personal to you?
Mm-hmm. Lead Belly was pretty personal. I think that he was a black male artist who was dealing with controlling his art and himself. And so there were a lot of similarities, I think, in that way. In this new project, Oleo, I actually ended up making up a character that is not me, but I think, you know, is carrying some of me along with him in an ethnomusicological kind of way. He's going around interviewing people who used to know Scott Joplin. You know, I guess I find pieces of myself in the other, in the other people in the manuscript. It's all about more or less black people who were creating art before it could be recorded. So you're talking about people creating songs, but they were never recorded. People, you know, Scott Joplin was never recorded, Blind Tom was never recorded, Blind Boone was never recorded, Sissy Retta Jones never recorded, Fisk Jubilee Singers were not recorded as a group until much later. I'm really interested in the very, very first troupe of Fisk Jubilee Singers. So my project is about trying to unearth the stories of these people who were involved in the creation of the black sound, of black music, before we had access to recording. So their voices are more or less lost.
Mm. Wow, so these people were never recorded, so you don't know what they sounded like at all?
Not really, no.
Wow.
For the most part, the only ones that were recorded were Burt Williams and George Walker.
So are you just like imagining how they sounded?
Pretty much. I mean, for the piano players, we have their music.
Okay.
So, you know, but as to seeing them in person and hearing them play, pretty much, no. There is no way to access that. The closest recording device that you had back in the 1870s, 80s, etc., was the pianola, player piano.
Mm-hmm.
And people could cut actual, it'd be almost like a computer readout. That was the closest they had to a computer readout of what the playing was like.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not their actual playing, so we don't know what they played like, you know, when they were just messing around. Those are the folks I'm interested in. It started to irk me that I did not know who they were.
So both Doug and Tayimba are part of Cave Canem. So I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a bit more about Cave Canem and also how it's contributed to your development as poets.
I applied to Cave Canem because my two favorite poets were going to be teachers there, Claudia Rankine and Carl Phillips. And I get off the plane and go wait for the shuttle, and there's Claudia Rankine right there. It's like, oh man. And immediately all the fandom is gone because she just becomes so real, and we just talk the whole time, and not even about poetry, you know, we just talk about life and why are you here and trip, how to get there and everything. And then, you know, and I would say that like for everybody, you just become so a part of somebody's family and so quick. And it, like your family, they just push you to write and do the best art you can do. You know, we have to do a workshop every day. You have to bring in a new poem every day. And, you know, they sit and look at, there's about 8 or 9 of us in a group, and you have to comment on those poems that are nascent and raw. And of course they need to be fixed, but Toy Derricotte, the other founder of Kaveh Kanem, is really big on you writing the poem that you are avoiding or afraid to write.
Hmm.
And the people in that room help bring it out of you.
Hmm.
So,
I'm a tenured professor at the College of Staten Island in the English department teaching creative writing. And I'm 100% sure that I would not have been able to do that without Kaveh Kanem.
Mm-hmm.
CC was a, it is a home for black poetry. I think that one of the things that makes it regenerative and powerful is that it is not stuck to, is not wed to any particular aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The guests, professors or the guest writers that come through that mentor, they can only come three times, just as the students can only come for three summers. So in that, what happens is you get a constant recirculation of all of the kind of advice or the input and insight that you would get. And it never stays in one place. And I think that that makes it a much more dynamic kind of family or tool, so to speak. Speaking in terms of American literature, I think it's been a transformative force.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the people that have come through CC,
mm-hmm.
Well, we just had one that just won the Pulitzer Prize. That would be Greg Parlow. And he was actually a student at CC. I think he's the first one who was an actual student at CC.
Tracy was a student. She
was
1 year.
Okay, yeah. Tracy K. Smith as well. So it's changed the face of American literature. It came at a time when it was long overdue.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also grown to see other groups model themselves after Kaveh Kanem.
Mm-hmm.
Kundiman.
Kantemundo,
right? So that kind of force has been just winding and winding for the last, well, this is 20 years now.
Yeah.
And I was there in the second year. And, back when nobody knew what Kaveh Kanem was.
Mm-hmm.
It was just really kind of a far-fetched idea. But now you can see the kind of impact that it's had with Douglas and all the people who grew up with. There are people in Kaveh Kanem now who have not known a world without Kaveh Kanem, not really.
You go on the website now and you just scroll through all the names. There's so many now, and
right.
So many of them have gone on to do such like amazing things.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive as it is, 20 years old, but only 20 years old. But like you said, it really filled a need.
Very much.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you all about just a phrase, Doug, that you were using about the poem that you are afraid to write, like the poem that you avoid. I think that's really interesting. And like for the two of you now, what kinds of poems are those for you? What poems are you afraid to write?
Well, I don't know, now that I know, that I should be going to that place. I think, though, as an emerging writer, getting back on the horse of writing, I thought it would come easier because, you have a book, you kind of figure this out, you know how things have happened. And, when people ask you for stuff, a lot of it gets printed right away, right? And so you wonder, where you need to go with it. And so when I started writing this, a new manuscript, this collaborative manuscript, I think I had a certain set of poems, and I looked at them, I'm like, you're just kind of going through the motions with it. You need to go deep, and these don't really hurt. These don't really say what you're really trying to say, and so I almost called myself out. And that happens at Kaveh Kanem too, where you're just around so much love and people will call you out on your, because they know your work, what you can do and what you're capable of going. And so I kind of did that, and I just really loved the place where it took me. And when I sent it to the collaborator, who's also a Kaveh Kanem poet, Jeffrey Davis, he looked at it and was like, wow, I'm glad you went to those places. I think he changed one word in the whole thing, and he's a he's a scholar and he reads really deeply. So for him to only change one word, that meant a lot. But I think the emotional strings I was trying to pull, and he really felt and got, and you know, and it's been really good for us to. It opens an avenue for us to have a conversation about fatherhood and about being Black fathers, but also being artists, and how can we pull those strings on each other and really get to the, you know, the heart of what the poem is really trying to do, you know, instead of just like trying to win awards or whatever, it's like, or just trying to get published. This is beyond that, because we're really trying to figure out our lives through these poems. So that's what it is.
Yeah, I think that's definitely taking the art beyond the idea of just creating an artifact, you know, and trying to make it something that that is transformative for the author as well. And I think that those and what you're talking about is vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, that's one of those things that I think we push ourselves towards in whichever way we can get to it.
I wonder now, like, does every good poem have to be vulnerable? But then I'm thinking, okay, there's lots of different kinds of good poems. But I also feel like the poems that move me the most, they're the vulnerable ones. I mean, somebody like Wallace Stevens, I always appreciate, but he never moves me. And I'm always a little bit distraught by how it's so intellectual for me. Like, it's an intellectual pleasure, but it's nothing beyond that. Like, he just kind of moves through me. So I don't know, do you think every good poem has to be vulnerable, or is that too simple a way of looking at it?
No,
I wouldn't say. I guess I would say, you know, that it doesn't have to be vulnerable, but it has to take a risk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something about, you know, there has to be a risk taken somewhere. And that risk can take a lot of different forms. It can be with enjambment. It can be with the subject matter. It can be with the way the poem is structured, etc. It has to be something at risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
like
that failure is not that far away.
Hmm.
You know.
That makes it sound like every poem is a little bit dangerous, because there's that danger of failure.
Yeah, I think generally there is that idea that there is, you know, what is failure? Because I mean, there's aesthetic failure,
mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? You know, what is it that you're toying with that brings you close to the brink of failure? You know, I think those are that's another way of being vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I heard a thing, one of my colleagues was talking about Fitzgerald in his class, and he had a quote, and I don't know the quote verbatim, but the gist of it was that a writer had to take a risk, and a writer had to go to places that would push him. And I was like, I thought Kaveh Kahneman invented that. It's Fitzgerald talking about this.
Right.
But it's true, even for him, I think. You know, you look at some of his other books, and I don't know if he really goes to the risk that he did with Gatsby, you know, and that's why people really gravitate towards it even to today. You know, we're talking about T.S. Eliot, you know, to create a poem that's as epic as Wasteland, but to go to each of those parts and to really go deep into it, He, you know, of course he wants to set out to talk about society as a whole, but each of those poems is so rich and deep and vulnerable in and of themselves that make us keep reading it. So, you know, I think Time is right. It's the subject matter, the form, you know, to write a contrapuntal is a hell of a risk. And you always, you know, when you write those poems, you feel like you're walking on a tightrope almost all the time, and I love that feeling that it's going to push me to the end of it, you know.
I had a professor once tell me that not every poem I write has to break my heart,
mm-hmm.
And it was at a time where I kind of felt like well, I did have to break my heart in order to write a poem. Like, that's what made a good poem. And I think he told me that, I don't know, but when he did tell me that, like, I'm putting together my manuscript right now, and I'll have, like, these little kind of, I don't know, these kind of poems that are just sheen.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, for me, it's like a break in the manuscript. So I feel like those kinds of poems can have, like, a place in terms of this is, like, a resting place before you get to, like, the...
Talking about a manuscript.
Yeah, yeah. For a manuscript.
Now, that's a different story.
Yeah.
That's a different thing.
Yeah, but it is different. Yeah.
I mean, because those poems you talk about with sheen, they're probably trying to work in some way to heighten.
Yeah.
Or throw into contrast the other stories, the other poems that are in the manuscript. It's kind of hard to go 100% all the time. I mean, all the way through
mm-hmm.
a manuscript. Although the idea should be, you're not thinking about, you're thinking about that poem in relationship to other poems in the manuscript.
At what point for you all do you start thinking about poems like as a manuscript and like writing poems for the manuscript rather than writing like poem as a poem, I guess? Yeah.
Well, I think it's hard for me now not to think of it. I guess I'm going to go back, and after thinking about what he said about his project, I'm working on a project where it's just going to take longer and more concentration, and that's to write about my namesake, Frederick Douglass. And so all of those poems feel like they're going together. You know, obviously the father poems feel like they're, because of the theme, they feel like they're going together. But I think when I do decide to put them together in it, there's some juggling that needs to happen. I feel like, kind of like what your professor was saying, I feel like there's some real estate, I always call it real estate poems, where you have these really nice poems, these great poems that get published in places and people like, and then you could throw in some maybe not as good poems around, but they're real estate. They get value for being next to these other poems.
Yeah,
so,
but
then also they lead to something greater. So there's some poems in the book that I never read, but I know they're necessary
mm-hmm.
like little steps to get you to
right.
the big door.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I guess the question was, at what point do you know that it's going to a manuscript? I'm pretty clear when it's going to go into a manuscript at this point. You know, I mean, I feel like I do have a whole lot of poems that haven't made their way into any kind of manuscript though. And
mm-hmm.
I guess what that is just a calling towards a different book, you know. When I'm writing about something biographical about somebody, then it starts to create the need for more poems along those lines. I don't know how much I'll do that in the future, how many more biographical works I'll do in the future. Probably time to leave it alone for a minute.
What do you think you would shift to?
Something historical but more personal
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible to go back and forth in the lens of history and see oneself as well as, you know, one's family, you know. So I'm interested a little bit in Detroit right now, my hometown. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what it's going to be yet, though. Yeah.
So music is very important to your poetry for both of you. So both of you have DJed. You still DJ, right, Doug? So I'm wondering, like, that experience of DJing, like, how has that influenced you as a poet?
Well, I was a jazz DJ at a
jazz
radio
DJ.
Station.
Mm. Okay.
So I was on WHBK FM Chicago 88.5. that was a great education in jazz. This is before the internet and
mm.
before you could just, you know, you could access all kinds of music with the tap of a finger. Had a 7,000 record jazz collection. And in the radio station. So it was like really a jazz education for me. And I also would do interviews.
Mm.
Interviews, a lot of interviews with black political prisoners and prisoners of war.
Mm.
And that was a really great, one of the most valuable things I did in college by far, because it fed me a lot. I was really, really, really intent on finding out what jazz was, because all the cool cats,
mm-hmm.
all the coolest cats do jazz. That's just the way it was.
I mean, your poetry sees that. Like, it's so kind of wild and delightful, and you can just kind of feel the texture of these words, like, in your mouth, and it kind of gets away from you. And it just, it's always on that edge of just, like, just breaking away from you. You can see just the energy there. How about you, for you, for the
DJing?
Yeah, I
think rhythm and language is always important, I mean, to a poet, right? But
mm-hmm.
As a DJ, I learned how to DJ on vinyl, and just I have turntables in my classroom because I have a little DJ group, and last week we busted out the vinyl. And when the kids left, I stayed in my classroom and just played vinyl record after vinyl record. And I hadn't done that in so long, and it's true, we are at a point where we could access anything at any time. You could find really obscure music at any time, but I think in terms of the poetry, we are also in my class going back and reading the Harlem Renaissance poets, and sometimes people can kind of put them on a shelf and say, well, we've been there and done that, but recently I've gone back, and vinyl for me, it's been so good, the way to feel a Langston Hughes poem again, and to really hear, which it looks really simple on the page, but it's so complex. And the same thing with vinyl, it looks and feels so simple, but it's so complex. So that's kind of the big picture thing.
And I think the other things you have to remember is that we know the African-American literature is just intimately and intricately, almost inseparably tied to the music,
mm-hmm.
because we were not allowed to read or write for the first, 200 or 300 years that we were in this country. So, it's when we see, the work songs and the blues,
mm-hmm.
and the spirituals and the gospel, those things are, they're really, even if you look through, I'd say, the majority of African-American literature,
mm-hmm.
you're going to find those traces there,
mm-hmm.
that lineage, that stream running through. So, it's really just working in the tradition.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
One question that occurred to me, this would be fun to ask, what's the most useful compliment you've received as a poet, and the most useful criticism you've received as a poet?
Probably, I would say useful criticism was someone told me the blues are about brevity. After a very long poem about the blues, they said the blues was about brevity. I'm okay, all right, I remember that one.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I think for me, my kids now are old enough to read my work, and I think my son or my daughter was like, it didn't happen that way. Or that's not how I remembered it. Or there's one poem I have, my son, he's like, why is that word in there? And the word was chemo. And I think his grandmother had just passed away on his mom's side, and she died of cancer. And it was like, you're right. And he didn't have to say anything else. He's like, you're right. That needs to go out. Because if he was going to be reading this all the time, I didn't want him to go back to that moment all the time with his grandmother. Because the poem doesn't really deal with that. It's really about how words are amazing, and for him to see that word and why it stuck out. So,
do you show the poems to them while you're still working on them?
Well, I just really my son just got back from South Africa, and he just told me the story about killing a snake, and I immediately went home and wrote a poem about it.
Hmm.
So I've been showing that to him, but usually, the new stuff I'm writing really deals with more the kind of the issues of them being older. So, they see things in the world, and the world affects them a lot, and I write about that. And there's, my kids are teenagers, so we don't always see eye to eye. So there's a lot of poems about that too. And that's the risk, right? To go to those parts of your life to deal with that, and if that's what it's doing. But I have not shown them those poems yet. I told my daughter about one. My daughter got called the N-word last year, and I told her I wrote a poem about that, and I was just trying to fact check it. So with her, she seemed to say I was on point with it. So
how about most useful compliment?
Probably, I think
the compliment that I needed the most at the time that I got it was a blurb I got from Sterling Plump. I wrote a book. It was a self-published. This is really going to be my third book. And I self-published a book in 93 called When Niggas Love Revolution Like They Love the Bulls.
And referring that one.
Right. It's hard to find.
Yeah.
But, you know, he took the time and, like, he wrote me a blurb for the book. And it was like, you know, it's not what I would write today, but it is the germ of what I'm writing with that.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that meant a lot to me. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, when that woman said that about me, about her father, it felt like her father was right behind her when she was reading the poems. I was, like, blown away. I didn't expect you to come here and make me cry in my own reading, you know, so.
So I'm curious just to hear you talk a little bit about contemporary poetry today, like some of the trends you're seeing. I know it's a big, huge landscape, and there's lots of different parts of that landscape, but I'm wondering if there's trends you're seeing, like what's appealing to you, what's not so appealing to you.
Oh, boy.
It's a huge question, because it's a huge landscape. But
it's a lot of, we were talking about that last night, it's a lot of books of poetry coming out.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to keep track. And
yeah, it used to be, there was... Really seriously, there'd be only like 5 or 6 books of black poetry. This is like in the 90s per year.
Per year.
And now it's got to be at least 20 to 25.
At least,
30,
yeah.
Maybe, so it's, I mean, I think that's beautiful. Is that, you know, it's the furious flowering,
mm-hmm.
so to speak, of African American literature. That I think is, it's going to be interesting to see what it's going to be like 10 years from now, because it's only going to be a multiple of what is going on going on today.
3 books for National Book Award for Poetry.
Right.
By African American poets. You know, 4 by the one of Ada Limon, so you have 4 people of color
right.
for National Book Award. I don't know how that's even happening. You know, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's just for poetry. I know Tracy K. Smith's book is up for nonfiction too, and Ta-Nehisi Coates, same
right.
thing. They're both for nonfiction, so you got 2 in another genre. You know, that's awesome, and that's just rare. So, in terms of like trend, is people of color, period, have made and are making a major impact on literature, and I would say the diversity of it is awesome. I think what Taimba said about Kaveh Khanna, that there's a diversity of voices there in poetry, and it makes us really, you know, you can forget. I grew up in a black community. You forget. You think we are all the same, even just doing that. But when you go to Kaveh Khanna, man, you just see like how different and diverse we are. And, you know, some of us only listen to hip-hop or jazz or Radiohead. Whatever, you know, or all of those, like me,
right.
right? Listen to all of it, and you forget. And to see the diversity of work come out of that is awesome, and on a major scene. So, I mean, if you flip through Terrence Hayes's most recent book, you just see a diversity of work just within that one little book that's so different than probably a lot of stuff he's done before. So that's awesome. And then you look at Robin's book or Ross Gay's book, they're all so different.
Yeah.
And I would say that with poetry in general. There's a lot of genres within the genre, right?
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
Yeah. Okay, well, cool. So we're going to end by having Taimba and Doug each read a poem. Okay, so Taimba's going to go first, and it looks like is this Olio, your book that's coming out?
Yes.
Ooh. So coming out in 2016.
Yes, it will be.
What's the name from? Like, what's
Olio.
Olio.
It means a mix, a melange.
Oh, okay.
Of things. And in this case, Olio came to mean the middle part of a minstrel show.
Mm. Okay.
Which was a variety act.
Mm-hmm.
The Olio eventually became Vaudeville. I use it in this case because we're dealing with a lot of artists that were working around and through the device of the minstrel show.
Mm-hmm.
This one, however, is about a sculptor named Edmonia Lewis. And she was probably the most successful African-American visual artist of the 19th century. She left the United States when she was in her very early 20s and went to Greece, where she could cut her own marble.
Wow.
But one of the things she cut she did before she left was a bust of Colonel Robert Gould Shaw. Robert Gould Shaw was the colonel that was head of the 54th, the Black Regiment.
Okay.
Who was killed with his men. So this is from the perspective of the Colonel Shaw, but also from the perspective of the actual statue.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you for that context. Okay.
Colonel Robert Gould Shaw, Edmonia Lewis Marble, 1866 to 1867. The enemy buried me with my brothers in blue. Our bloodlines mingled in the mangled makeshift ditch, burrowed beneath sand and grit to huddle in Earth's quarried memory. We lay head to head, bone to bone, with eternity. Then her hands summoned me, bade marble limn these eyes, speak these lips. So I faced the world again, wishing I could call my men once more to stand at attention. Rigby, who drawl curses on red rebs while drawing Colt revolvers. Allison, who'd sworn not to die till whipping his old master, his father, before his freed mother's eyes. Roper, his every inch mapped with lash marks that branded his route through hell. And 1,100 more in the 54, with 1,100 blue-black stories to tell. Her hands somehow searched out each tale those men carved into my face, scraping away marmoreal myths that define which race might rule. She cut dark witness into this bust that carries forth my image. Proof that, in the end, it's a mortal stone that wins when we're all dead and finished.
All right, Doug.
All right. This is called These Dead Days. My father's laughter still bellows over everything. His utterance peaks with the morning paper, a mist of bacon-scented ink wakes me. Lingers high above my head, his bass advises, plucks the blues back into my second chances, his cello grinding scats of R&B veracity. Tell it like it is. Go on and live, baby. Go on and live. His timber, so pentagrass, blocks my fear of heights, guides me through the dark, a slack tone after rosé. He visits the corner liquor store, a bottle, a scratch-off, whets his hope for me, his bootstrapping do-it-all tone, turned up to 10 so I could get up early and off to work. His southern manners, singing no nonsense, his Folgers, his Palmolive, and his Clorox Panacea will get me out of trouble when I need it to. The wisdom has the practicality of tea and the know-it-all of a path deep in the woods. Today, the grass grows in his throat, his voice muffled by a coffin. But I hear the Haints roam Mississippi's remarkable heat. My dad's voice throughout the day's dead temperature, warbling towards me.
Thank you. Day's the grass grows in his throat.
Yeah.
Those lines.
Nice one.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both so much for coming in today to the Missouri Review.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast, music by Mark Catalano. Check us out online at MissouriReview.com, where you can subscribe to the magazine and enter our annual Miller Audio Prize in poetry, prose, audio documentary, and humor. Deadline March 15, 2016. Thanks for listening, and check back next week for a new episode of the Missouri Review Sound Booth Podcast.